It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, glad you could be here. Some Wisconsin farmers are cultivating a new crop, energy. Across the state, developers are partnering with rural landowners to build 100-acre solar farms. As Wisconsin Public Radio contributor Jana Rose Schleiss reports, it's a trend that's likely to continue.
Ken Duvenek was a dairy farmer for all of his life. By 2007, he was 60 years old, and his health made it difficult to continue.
My knees were gone. I had one knee replaced, and it was just kept to the point where I couldn't hardly do it no more. I know the kids, my sons, they weren't going to milk no more, and I had just gotten to the point where I just couldn't do it no more, you know.
Duvenek tried other ways to earn farm income.
And I kept raising heifers after that. I bought them and sold them. And then that went good for a while. But then that market went out.
Then in 2018, like his neighbors, Duvenek and his wife Rita signed a 30-year contract to lease their land for solar energy generation. Now, past the red barns of the Duvenek farm in the tiny town of Two Creeks, 40 acres of solar panels rotate towards the sun. Duvenek said the solar contract is an opportunity to keep the land and the farm in his family. Ken's wife, Rita, said it was a hard decision to temporarily give up the land on their fourth-generation farm, but she's glad the solar panels allow them to cultivate a different kind of crop.
You know, so what? We farm the sun. So.
Consumer demand for renewable energy is growing. Developers are partnering with farmers to meet those demands. Farmers have what solar energy companies need, land. Hosting solar panels allows dairy farmers to diversify their income in a market that can sometimes be unpredictable. Brent Sinkula is the president of the Manitowoc County Farm Bureau. He says the changing market has made it difficult for smaller farms to survive.
It's that middle that seems to be kind of falling out, and that's where I am.
In 2018, the company NextEra Energy asked Sinkula if he would rent 500 acres of his farm for solar panels. It meant giving up a third of his land, but gaining an extra income.
It was an easy decision, no, but you know, after my parents and I talking it over and discussing, we decided, you know, it'd be nice to have something to fall back on.
Now the cows on Irish Acres Dairy graze right next to rows and rows of glistening photovoltaic panels absorbing the sun's rays. Two Creeks is a lakeshore community nestled between Manitowoc and Door County. NextEra Energy has developed two large-scale solar farms here, spanning over 1,200 acres. The town has a long history with the energy industry. Since the 1970s, Two Creeks has been home to the Point Beach nuclear plant. James Tingem researches renewable energy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He says there are three things that make a community an ideal location to develop energy facilities: transmission capacity, willing landowners, and a power purchase agreement.
You got those three things, you've got a project.
Tingem said existing infrastructure, like transmission lines to move the energy, is a big reason why energy companies are attracted to places like Two Creeks. The town and the county receive utility tax payments for hosting the energy facilities. Town Chairman Lee Engelbrecht hopes the additional money from the solar farms can be used to help maintain roads.
I think it's good for the town, it's good for the county, and we need energy. Everybody wants to go to that light switch and expects it to go on when they flip it on.
NextEra plans to expand its renewable energy developments in Wisconsin to the tune of $2 billion. Sinkula and Duvenek both say they've gotten calls from other farmers who want to know whether farming the sun might work for them. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Jana Rose Schleiss.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Scientists are working on ways to capture PFAS and destroy them, but it's not simple with these toxic human-made forever chemicals that are pervasive in our environment, especially in wells near chemical manufacturing plants and airports using firefighting foam. But a breakthrough now to this growing global health threat with research published last month in the journal Science. Join in on the work to eliminate PFAS chemicals, 800-642-1234. Dan Jones is a professor in the Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology at Michigan State University, associate director of its Center for PFAS Research. Dan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Kate, thank you for having me today.
Well, we've nicknamed them forever chemicals because they don't go away. They don't degrade. Does the science that's emerging mean that that label is no longer correct?
Well, I mean, when we say call them forever chemicals, it's really that there are very few natural processes, especially in the soil and water, whereby these compounds will break down into harmless materials. So there are many groups that are working on developing technologies to try to break them down, but there are a lot of challenges that all of them still face, because these are very stable chemicals. They're difficult to break down. But the paper that was published by the Northwestern group in Science recently showed that there was some novel chemistry that really hadn't been appreciated before that has potential to lead these kinds of developments further.
And you're examining methods of breaking down PFAS. And you say once PFAS are filtered out of water or another substance, that they must be destroyed. You can't store or bury them in a landfill. Why is that?
Well, in part because they don't break down, and they're somewhat mobile in the environment. So if we bury them in the landfill and then rainwater percolates through the landfill, eventually these chemicals migrate through the soil and end up in groundwater. And then from there, they move on to other bodies of water and into our food supply.
What happens if you incinerate PFAS?
Well, if you have a flame that's hot enough, you probably can break them down very efficiently. But there are relatively few incinerators that operate at such high temperatures that have been documented really to be effective in breaking down the wide range of different PFAS chemicals. So incineration is an option, but at least in the state of Michigan, I'm not aware of any incinerators that operate under the conditions that would pretty much guarantee that that these chemicals would be broken down into harmless materials.
And that's the crux of it. If organic chemists can create these seemingly indestructible chemicals, these forever stable, as you say, then they shouldn't they also have the knowledge and ability to break them apart and destroy them, to undo their handiwork?
Well, we don't really require that of manufacturers and people who develop new chemicals, to insist that the chemicals don't have almost infinite lifetimes in the environment. That's not a requirement, especially for chemicals that are not viewed as being harmless when at the time of their development, or being harmful at the time of development. So it's we don't really, as a world, we don't really demand that the materials that we develop are eventually going to break down through natural processes.
But you really have to pay attention, though, to what you're creating and its entire life cycle, especially as scientists try to develop ways to destroy PFAS.
Oh, yes, absolutely. The biggest, one of the biggest challenges with PFAS is that there are so many different chemicals. And a process may break down some of them, but not all of them, but we don't even have reference materials to work from for many of these chemicals. They're not commercially available. Beyond that, the processes may end up creating more damaging compounds by breaking down PFAS. We might turn salts and sort of natural substances into hazardous substances. So we have to look at the bigger picture of how do we dispose of chemicals and how long do we want them to last. I mean, these products are really valuable from a consumer's point of view, but from an environmental point of view, everything should be designed so that it doesn't last forever.
We have Michigan State biochemist Dan Jones with us working on PFAS containment techniques, what the future holds for these so-called forever chemicals leaching into our environment. Join in on the challenges of destroying PFAS. What questions come up for you? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers have developed potentially promising methods to destroy a class of PFAS chemicals using lye, which is a common, inexpensive ingredient. So-called forever chemicals, they're widely used in products like firefighting foams, nonstick cookware, makeup, waterproof clothing. And they typically don't break down. So degrading one major type of PFAS in the lab could be a step forward. Join in on the science of tackling PFAS in the environment. Potential solutions, 800-642-1234. Michigan State biochemistry professor Dan Jones is associate director of the university's Center for PFAS Research and stays with us. Dan, your colleagues at Michigan State are working on a way to add materials to soil that would prevent plants from taking up PFAS. Now, when I think of PFAS, I often think of water contamination, not about the soil, not about, you know, the plants. Can you explain the issues there in the environment?
Well, I'll give an example of of some of the problem. Some the chemicals that end up in water sometimes end up being treated in wastewater treatment plants. And the PFAS chemicals are not degraded there. They end up in the biosolids, in this instance, the sludge. And in many cases, that sludge is then applied to farms as fertilizer. So the PFAS are moving from the water into the sludge and then into the farms, where in some cases they could be taken up by crops, they could be taken up by livestock, and they then have potential to enter the food supply. So because the chemicals don't break down naturally, and certainly they don't break down in wastewater treatment, we really just move them around from one place to the next in the absence of having a way to destroy them.
What ultimately would be the best way to either store them or make them so they wouldn't leach into other areas of the natural world, the environment?
Well, my colleague, Professor Hoi Lee, is working on soil amendments, things that you can add to the soil that that might bind up the PFAS or at least slow down their migration into the water, into groundwater, and into uptake into crops. And there are many different approaches that may work, but the long-term issue is probably, we still need to find ways to break them down. And even more importantly, we need to find ways to eliminate those chemicals that are going to cause problems. So, there are replacement chemicals that probably could be suitable substitutes that are not going to last nearly as long as many of the PFAS chemicals do.
You mentioned this earlier, and let's dig in a bit deeper. Scientists at Northwestern, they released research last month showing that a class of PFAS can be broken down into mostly harmless components using sodium hydroxide, the lye that used to be commonly used in soap. What do you see in this research? What is new to you here?
Well, I think just the real novelty is that these chemical reactions work in the first place. But I don't think they've been widely appreciated that this could work. But to get them to work, they have to use a particular kind of solvent, which then, of course, to implement this, you'd need to remove that solvent from the drinking water. But the really important advance here is to show that the process works. And now there's a lot of work that needs to be done probably to optimize this and to find ways to scale it up so that it can be useful on a large scale contamination site and not just in the laboratory.
Right, because
That's generally true. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was going to say this.
That's generally true for
The solvent DMSO, I mean, how do you dispose of it? One scientist questioned the real-world application of this breakthrough because you can't put DMSO down the drain.
Well, I mean, DMSO is largely a harmless chemical. It's, I mean, not entirely true for just about anything, but DMSO, you would eventually, if you're using it and mixing it in with water, you would want to remove it from the water. And that, of course, takes energy. It has some costs associated with it. So there's a lot of engineering in this and really almost all of the technologies to try to make them useful on a large scale. I mean, many work beautifully at the small scale in the laboratory, but to get them to work with, you know, millions of gallons of water or many acres of contaminated soil is another story altogether.
Or 12,000 types of PFAS, I would imagine. I mean, how can a method developed in a lab, you know, using lye and DMSO be applied to other types of classes of PFAS and be scaled up enormously?
Well, I think that the important thing is that they've discovered that this kind of chemistry can happen. Now, how to make it happen and make it practical is another, that's really an engineering problem more than anything else. But there's a lot of additional basic science research that will need to be done to find the right conditions. I mean, DMSO was proposed in part because it's mostly harmless and it's relatively inexpensive as a solvent.
But it still
would need to be removed from the water supply.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the challenges of destroying PFAS with Dan Jones. He is the Associate Director for Michigan State University's Center for PFAS Research. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Jane is with us from Suamico. Jane, hi. What would you like to bring up?
I'd really like to hear him comment on what I've been hearing, that there is a large group of these kind of chemicals, like 5,000 different variations, and that the legislature and the Natural Resources Board don't want to call them, you know, they don't want to call individual ones out because there are so many of them.
So the quantity, Jane, brings up, what roadblocks do you see there, Dan, especially as states try to regulate PFAS?
This is one of the big challenges that I think we particularly face with PFAS, is that there are so many different chemicals, and we know very little about which ones are the most harmful and those that are not. There are two that the EPA has designated to be considered as hazardous chemicals, and that will enable certain kinds of regulations. But that ignores, I mean, one estimate I saw recently was that there are maybe 12,000 different PFAS chemicals, and that number is, and that number is growing all of the time. So how we regulate them and how we assess what the health effects are of being exposed to mixtures are two big areas of research, and those are some things that my colleagues around the world are really working on.
What are the issues and obstacles around the cost of cleanup efforts? You looked at a project near a former military base in Sacramento that has cost over $3 million to date, and that's just to prevent PFAS from going into the drinking water of one single community. Why are cleanup efforts so costly?
Well, the scale is really the issue. The unit that we described in our piece in the conversation on in the Sacramento area is next to a defunct Air Force base, and it's processing, you know, thousands of gallons a minute of water. But the size of the activated carbon filters and the pumps and the equipment that's needed is really substantial. And you're right that this only addresses a very localized area. We don't really have a complete understanding across the U.S. just where the hot spots of contamination are. So the big part that has to precede all of this is to identify where is the problem the worst and to try to intervene where most human health and most wildlife health is likely to be affected.
Dan, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Kate. Hope that we raise some awareness in the public that that these are issues that are going to be with us for a while.
Indeed. Dan Jones, professor in the Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology at Michigan State, associate director of its Center for PFAS Research. We have a link to the research article in the journal Science at WPR.org/mornings. Up ahead, we delve into the pros and cons behind baby bonds with a UCLA professor who studies these trust funds that mature in adulthood. Could they address the wealth gap in America? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. News update and a story from Wisconsin Life. They're next on the Ideas Network.
Tortillas, tortillas, necesitas una tortilla. Tortillas, tortillas, necesitas una tortilla. Si quieres una quesadilla, necesitas una tortilla. Si quieres un taco, necesitas una tortilla. Si quieres una tostada.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the simple joys of making tortillas.
Many of us have strong memories tied to making food with our families. Writer Araceli Esparza shares a poem about the bonds that are nurtured while making fresh, fluffy tortillas from scratch.
She gets the flour. She gets the flour and the salt. She gets the flour, the salt, and the water. Hungry for my cloud tortillas. Waiting feels like a year. The water, the flour, and the salt in a bowl, she begins. Hungry hunger rumbles in my tummy. She folds in the parts of my cloud and tells the dough how much I will love what it will become. Pitter-patter, thump-thump, everyone comes down the stairs. And now we all squeeze in to watch Josita, Tommy, Lupita, and even little Juanito. On the table, she rolls a little ball of masa. Will I get my own? Then she centers the masa ball on the tortilla press, pulls down the lid, and presses hard. Pat, pat with her manos. Five kids watching, waiting. Will I get my own? Smack on the comal on the stove. Dale vuelta, tia. Give it a turn, tia. We whisper, shout. Little Juanito begins to whine. My cloud tortilla dream begins to evaporate. Couple of turns and browning, bubbles form. Will they burn? My cloud tortilla was done all fluffy, light, and warm. Tia asks, who wants the first tortilla? Everyone answers, me, 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 me. But I say, yo, por favor. Tia gives me the puffy treat I've been waiting for, and I float to the ceiling. I spread a butter moon on top of my tortilla, but I see little Juanito, and I roll it up and give it to him. And I show him how the cloud eating is done.
That's Madison writer Araceli Esparza sharing a poem about making tortillas. I asked her why she wanted to write about food and her family.
I remember as a small child, like, going up to New Berlin with my great aunt and my grandmother and my mother and, like, all of us driving up there to visit her. They've known each other for so long, and, like, just her cooking and, like, the flour tortillas, oh, my gosh. I never seen somebody, like, make them by hand. So when you go in Mexico, you typically see corn tortillas made in a machine, a tortilla, right? And so, but to see the process done by hand and then just the, it was so methodical and just so yummy. Oh, my gosh, just like a slice of heaven.
So what have tortillas meant to you in your life?
You know, when I think about all the debates that's happening right now and what can bring us together, people often say breaking bread. Let's break some tortillas together, right? We can have country tortillas. We love our street tacos. Let's talk about that more and, like, let's talk to each other while we're breaking tortillas, maybe. I have tons of little tortilla stories about like one time I like, you know, when you have an electric stove, like, okay, so I get kind of picky of how to cook them. Like a gas stove tortillas are just so much better than an electric stove, right? But sometimes, okay, with electric stove, you have to really watch when you make them, and they can come up actually rubbery and hard. And so there's this anecdotal moment that I remember clearly with my grandmother, and I had an electric stove, you know, I was living in apartments and stuff, and like I make her these tortillas, and like she takes a bite and like literally throws it at me. Like, this is not quality, girlfriend. Like, you know what I mean? Like, she's like, I've taught you better. And I'm like, I'm dealing with an electric stove, abuelita, you know, this isn't, there's not a gas stove here.
Araceli Esparza is a writer based in Madison and host of the podcast Midwest Mujeres. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Tortilla, tortilla, necesitas una tortilla. Tortilla, tortilla, necesitas una tortilla. Si quieres una quesadilla, necesitas una tortilla. Si quieres un taco, necesitas una tortilla. Si quieres una tostada, necesitas una tortilla. Si quieres una enchilada, necesitas una tortilla. Si quieres chilaquiles, necesitas una tortilla. Si quieres nachos, necesitas una tortilla. Si quieres un burrito, necesitas una tortilla. Si quieres una sopapilla.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now to baby trust funds and the racial wealth gap in America. These baby bump programs are designed to give an infusion of money at a critical time in the lives of our nation's poorest children. Here in Wisconsin, Democratic lawmakers put forth a baby bond bill last year. Under the plan, the state would invest $3,000 for Medicaid-eligible families, and access to the funds would be granted at age 18. Join in on baby trusts where you see social policies like this headed. 800-642-1234. Naomi Zodi is Assistant Professor of Health Economics at the University of California, Los Angeles School of Public Health. Naomi, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, so set us up with a working knowledge of baby bonds first. What is this money? How does it grow?
So the idea is that, you know, you set the money aside when they're a baby, and they can look forward to knowing that over time it is growing on their behalf. Maybe it's being invested, and that when they become a young adult, they will have, you know, a more substantial sum of money to make big decisions on. You know, so it's different from, say, income supports or food stamps, which are really about helping to meet their immediate needs every month, you know, meeting whatever basic physiological needs that there's so many of them that children need as they're growing up. So it's separate from that. You know, it's a larger sum of money when you become a young adult. And the idea is to be able to kind of springboard your life on that, you know, so it acts as wealth, you know, as a trust fund. You can move to another city, you can go to school, you can, you know, buy a house, whatever, like kind of big things that you might want to set up for your life.
How do you ensure the money grows? I mean, are these treasury bonds? Are they something else? How would you do more of a traditional investment, like a college saving plan 529 structure?
So the idea is that, you know, it kind of depends on how the legislation ultimately turns out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's called baby bonds, but really I think the way you called it, baby trusts, is more accurate. You know, just investing it in something like a money market mutual fund, an index fund, something that's kind of relatively guaranteed steady returns over time would probably be best. But it wouldn't necessarily be, it'd be different from a 529 in that it's not like the personal responsibility of the individual parent, which, you know, who has so many other things going on. It would be like a program more like it would just be invested on their behalf in some kind of larger investment scheme that maybe, you know, the state government would set up and structure so that there it would be like interest bearing over time, and it would continue to grow over time on their behalf without parents necessarily having to go out of their way to put money into those accounts. Or monitor the investments over time.
And if families aren't able to put money into accounts or able to, you know, to add to them or to watch them grow, how do you develop a culture of saving? Is that a problem?
Well, I think the best way to develop a culture of saving is to develop a situation where you have extra money at the end of the month to be able to save, you know,
mm-hmm.
Especially for parents that we're talking about. Like, you know, a lot of wealth is intergenerationally transmitted. If your parents have the space to help you put a down payment on your home, you're going to be much more likely to buy a home. You know, what's the difference between renters and homeowners? It's mostly the down payment and whether or not they had the margin to build that up or they had the help to put that down. So, you know, I think like, but one really useful thing that could come out of it would be some kind of financial advising, you know, which is different kind of from financial literacy. You know, it's not about, okay, take a quiz, like what does X, Y, and Z mean, but really just somebody who can explain to people within their particular financial situations, what would be the consequences of this decision versus the other one? You know, what does it mean to have an index fund versus, you know, kind of throwing all your money into Tesla or something, you know? What are different ways that you can grow you know, investments over time and the riskiness of these relative choices? Just that kind of educational information mm-hmm. or just really advising can go a long way.
Naomi, let's look at these test cases. Washington, D.C., probably the first one here starting, a baby trust program, city putting $1,000 into trust funds for low-income children. Connecticut also starting off offering $3,200. What do you see going on around the country and in these programs that we should take note of?
I think it's really exciting. You know, I think that the larger sum is really important. So, you know, if Wisconsin's thinking about 3,000, Connecticut as well, I know they projected that by the time they turn 18, it would be worth about 15,000, which I think is a much more meaningful sum of money in the grand scheme than, you know, a $1,000 investment. Even if it does triple at that point, it's going to be kind of more akin to a month's salary as opposed to like a couple of months' salary, especially for a young adult. And that larger sum is what I think has the potential to have a bigger impact in shaping their young adult lives. You know, it would be meaningfully different from getting a couple $100, which isn't going to change anybody's life. So, you know, yeah.
In 2019, I mean, you have research that looks at what would $15,000 mean to a young person entering adulthood. What is the impact?
Well, there's a couple. I mean, for one thing, you know, in terms of the racial wealth gap, I don't know. It's hard sometimes to wrap our minds about what we mean by the racial wealth gap. But if you look not just at young adults, but at, you know, all American households, the median Black American household, so just the person right in the middle, 50th percentile, has less than $20,000 in net worth, so around $17,000. So half of all Black American households have less than $17,000 in net worth, whereas the corresponding figure for the median white American household is $172,000.
Mm.
So it's just a completely different scale. And this is because of, you know, intergenerational legacies of historical disadvantage. You know, if we think about like civil rights, it just happened in the 70s that Black people were allowed to go to the same schools and occupy the same professions. And it takes generations to build up wealth. So we're making much more progress on income inequality than we are on wealth inequality. So what my research found was that, you know, when I studied it, we were seeding larger funds, like up to 50,000. Everybody gets something, but those whose parents have, you know, the most wealth at birth would only get about $500. And then the least wealth would get 50,000, and it would kind of, you know, in between, we just fill it in. But like everybody gets something, some get more, some get less. Anyway, so when they became young adults, you know, if we look at young adults today, the wealth discrepancy, it's actually really substantial, maybe more than you would think, because as you're growing up, you're saving more and you might think that it grows wider over time. But even at young adulthood, the difference between the white and Black young adults was pretty substantial. It was a factor of 15.9. So basically, the median white young adult had 16 times the net worth as the, you know, the median young black adult household.
Wow.
But with these baby bonds, that reduces to a factor of 1.4. So they only had 1.4 times as much. And the size of the overall program at the federal level, it was about $80 billion, which is, you know, food stamps is $73 billion. So it'd be like a similar size to other kinds of federal programs that we have, you know, basically like really honestly feasible. And we could bring young adults, we could almost eliminate amongst young adult households that racial wealth gap. So,
well, let's pause right there with UCLA health economist Naomi Zodi studies the ability of these new policies like baby trust bonds to reduce economic inequality, the challenges with the racial wealth gap. Join in on generational poverty, on income inequality, and what you think of baby bonds as a fix. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore baby bond programs underway around America, what these baby trust funds could mean for Wisconsin's poorest families. Last year, both Washington, D.C. and Connecticut passed baby bonds legislation, ushering in state-funded trust programs for children and families with low income. The Urban Institute, it calls baby bonds an economic birthright to capital. Join in on these trust funds and how to close the large racial wealth gap in our country that we've been talking about. 800-642-1234. Naomi Zodi is assistant professor of health economics at UCLA and stays with us. Naomi, Wisconsin Democratic lawmakers last year, they proposed placing $3,000 in bonds for each baby born to Medicaid-eligible families in Wisconsin. And the legislation put recipients, you know, being able to use the money to buy a home, pursue higher ed, start a business, contribute toward retirement or investments, or pay for childcare. Should there be restrictions on how the money can be used?
You know, I can understand kind of both sides of the argument. On the one hand, you know, I think that the way that they've set it up is good. They can put it in the IRA if you really need to cash it out. I mean, you know, imagine you just need like a kidney transplant and you've got this money, but you can't use it towards that end. Mm. The concept of financial investments becomes moot, you know, but at least being able to put it in the IRA, and yeah, there's penalties if you remove it early, but there's a way that makes it possible. You know, it's kind of the last resort cash out option is still available to people, but at the same time, it's encouraging, you know, using these funds towards, you know, the future, which we all need.
Well, let's look now at the federal level, because in 2020, when Senator Cory Booker ran briefly for the Democratic presidential nomination, he really campaigned on a federal program. He has since introduced legislation that would create that program. What are your thoughts about a federal approach to baby trust funds?
I think that it's probably going to be necessary, especially at the scale that's needed. A lot of state budgets have to be balanced, and there's so many different pressures on state budgets, like Medicaid spending. So I think that a federal program is probably necessary for it to be fully implemented. But then at the states, it's good because they can kind of pilot it, get it off the ground, and we can watch how it works.
Right, because, you know, D.C., the real first test case, costing $32 million for the first 4 years alone. Do you see states proposing programs and then perhaps getting cold feet over the cost? Like, how do you maintain this funding?
That's right. I think, well, you know, one good thing is that there's only so many babies that are born each year. So it's kind of different from having a program that's for the entire population of the city.
Mm-hmm.
So that helps to manage the cost. $32 million, when we're thinking about government expenditures, it's pretty feasible. But yes, I do think that states are always weary to add really anything to their budget.
The Urban Institute said you really need automatic enrollment if you want participation to be at the level that it should be, and so you don't have disadvantaged families being left out What kind of hoops should a family go through to enroll in a baby bond program?
Yeah, I mean, I would say zero. I totally agree with that statement that, like, basically what you can do is just have enough set aside for each baby that's born, but don't make them, you know, prove what X, Y, and Z in order to be set up at the beginning. You know, I think the way that Connecticut's law has been set up, which it's been passed through the legislature, signed by the government, it hasn't yet been implemented, but it should be soon. That's the way that they did it. So whenever the person turns 18, that's the point at which they can, they just need to bring some kind of proof that they were born in the state during that year, and then that will make them eligible at that time.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about baby bonds with Naomi Zodi, who's an assistant professor of health economics at UCLA. You can join in 800-642-1234. So as you see Connecticut ramping up with the program, you see the D.C. program and some federal traction on this. What are you watching for next on a social program like this?
I think we're just trying to see, you know, how they keep in touch with these young adults, these children as they're growing up. You know, is there any kind of data that we can gather about how it might be affecting, you know, what's called future orientation? So the way that they're able to think about the future. I went to a press conference when Connecticut was first passed through the legislature, and there was a woman there. She was pregnant and her child should be born eligible for these baby bonds. And she was saying how she is really happy to be living with her mother-in-law because it's amazing to have a roof over your head, you know, but maybe had she had access to these baby bonds, she'd buy a house too, you know, and she's really happy that her child can make those choices when they become a young adult. So I think, like, even, you know, they don't get the money until they turn 18, but I'd be interested to see what kinds of benefits or effects we might see, you know, even earlier.
And you know, that might you be able to watch that, as you said, future orientation happening less than 18 years, you know, because you really, this is a long-term thing.
Right. So even as children, you know, you can survey parents and children right before the eligible date cutoff and right after, which is always unfortunate, the fact that you have that those sharp cutoffs, but once they're there, then just it's an opportunity to understand what these things mean so that we can invest in more programs like that if we do find benefits. But just to ask them, you know, are you thinking about college? You know, what kinds of plans are you making for your future? And to understand, like, well, maybe people who are like, oh, I'm actually going to be able to afford to make those kinds of choices as a young adult might be investing in their futures in a different way.
Naomi, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Naomi Zodi is Assistant Professor of Health Economics at the University of California, Los Angeles School of Public Health. Just ahead, we talk about the future of passenger rail service in Wisconsin, the corridors, the connections, the 2050 plan. What's on your mind about boarding a train? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.